early on, Manning was held in Kuwait. And so most of our early conversations, obviously, were by telephone. When she was transferred to the Quantico Marine Corps base for confinement, that was the first time I got to actually meet her in person. And at that point, I was struck by how small she was. She was not in a very good place mentally at that point as well. So our early conversations were less about the case and more about trying to ensure that mentally she was in a good place.
What was your theory of the case then going forward, the defense that you were going to make? Did you try to make a plea arrangement?
Early on, it became clear there wasn't going to be a real issue as to who released the information. The government had very good forensic evidence to show that it was, in fact, Manning that had released the information to WikiLeaks. So then the only question became, what would be the outcome? I actually held out hope that we'd be able to resolve this in a fair manner that would recognize that Manning did not have authorization to release the information, but then more importantly, recognize that the information released was not, you know, the codes to our nuclear weapons. It was not the most sensitive information. I was hopeful that cooler minds would prevail and the case would be resolved quickly. The reality of the situation was, unfortunately, as in so many cases, when it's a high-profile case, people do things differently than they normally would. And in this instance, that really revolved around an aiding the enemy offense that was unprecedented, and also a kind of take-no-prisoners approach where they really wanted to have a sentence that was in the, you know, 50, 60-year range.
Now, the aiding the enemy charge, she was not convicted of that.
No, correct? She was not, no. If you can wrap your mind around the government's reasoning behind this, their whole idea was not to say that Manning was trying to get information to the enemy. It was simply by providing information to WikiLeaks, knowing that WikiLeaks would put that information on the web, on the internet, that the enemy then could access it. And therefore, now you've aided the enemy. And if you really think about that, what that means is anytime somebody provides information, classified information, to a journalist, whether that's WikiLeaks, the Washington Post, New York Times, or NPR, that if you publish it, now all of a sudden that your source is aiding the enemy. That kind of legal rationale is so difficult to rationalize in a country where we value the First Amendment. And it's dangerous if, in fact, that becomes the mindset of the government.
Well, wouldn't that also make the vehicle of the publication guilty of aiding the enemy?
It could. And the dangerous thing we saw during the Obama administration was an unprecedented attack against whistleblowers. And part of that was the government looking at journalists. You have very high-profile examples of that where they obtained information on AP reporters and one search affidavit with regards to, of all places, Fox News. The affiant, the officer who was trying to get the search warrant, indicated that the Fox News reporter was aiding and abetting the disclosure of classified information.
Now, you've written that you were shocked when the judge sentenced Manning to 35 years, the harshest sentence ever handed down in a leak case at that time. But the sheer number of the documents, whole archives that your client copied and gave to WikiLeaks has also been called extraordinary. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, what do you see as the significance of this case?
I think this case will represent maybe in 10 to 20 years an example of our problem with overclassification. Obama, to his credit, tried to address that, but it unfortunately didn't change. Our government classifies so much information that doesn't need to be classified. This is a good example of an overclassification case because although you had hundreds of thousands of documents, without going into great detail, I can tell you that none of the information released was actually information that caused damage, in my mind, or information that couldn't have been declassified once it was released. Arguably, it should have been declassified even before Manning's disclosures to WikiLeaks.
This case had a number of twists and turns. Of course, most notably, the moment when your client came out as transgender and began using the name Chelsea. Was that a surprise to you?
It wasn't. It was one of the early conversations that we had back in 2010. So I was aware of this issue almost from the very beginning. We didn't want to make the fact that Manning was transgender an issue in the trial. But as soon as the trial was over, it was the very next day after sentencing, that's when I went on the Today Show and conveyed the information that Manning was transgender and wanted to be referred to as Chelsea.
David Coombs, what have you heard from Chelsea since her release? How is she doing, and what will she do now?
Well, you can see from her Twitter account and her Instagram account that she is just trying to navigate herself back into a non-incarcerated condition of her existence. She has a lot of support by people who have donated now in excess of $150,000 to aid in her transition to now civilian life. I think Manning's going to take a few months to basically get her bearings and then try to live a normal life, hopefully.
Attorney David Coombs is a visiting professor at Roger Williams Law School and has a law practice in downtown Providence. He was the lead defense attorney for Chelsea Manning. Thank you for sharing your reflections on this case with us, David.
Thank you, Chuck, for having me.